The Business Buzz Podcast.
The Business Buzz.
Good evening and welcome to The Business Buzz for your weekly dose of business, finance and economics news right here on Voice of Wits FM 88.1, broadcasting live from our studios in Bloemfontein, Johannesburg. My name is Tlengiwe Londiwe Zondo and I will be your host for tonight. Who said business can't be entertaining? Hold on to your seats as we unpack educational entertainment for your growth. Today, we are going to be talking about corporate ethics. At a time or another, we've all benefited from a well-led discussion on ethics. So today, we're hoping to shed some light on the subject of corporate ethics and the dilemmas that come with it. Hopefully, we're all going to walk away with a bit of clarity around ethics and we'll be able to assess for ourselves and our business environment what constitutes as ethical and how to apply it consistently within our business environment. So we're going to have a chat with Nkosana Makate, who's the Please Call Me founder. And we're also going to get Vodacom's perspective and viewpoint on the current saga that's playing itself out currently in the media. And we're also going to talk and get a business perspective from Khosi Dipokwane. I hope I'm getting his name correct. He'll correct us later on if need be. And last but not least, we're also going to get to hear the voices of the people from the ground. We're also going to touch on in the next hour the business wrap as well as the business index. And remember, if you are listening right now, that we are available on the following social media platforms. On Facebook, we are Vow FM, Voice of Wits, and Wits Radio Academy. On Twitter, we are at Vow FM, and our hashtag is Business Buzz. On WhatsApp, you can touch base with us on 084-078-4912. And our podcasts of the show are available on www.wits.journalism.co.za/business. Make sure to keep growing with us right here on 88.1 via FM until 8 p.m. Next up, we have Zanele Kunene with us on the Business Wrap.
You're tuned in to the Business Buzz.
So we're just going to wrap things up a little bit, twist things up, and we're going to start off first with the Buffalo Index. And remember, this is the part of the show when we inform you on the state of your 100 Rand. And based on today's topic, we are going to be looking at a couple of business ethic books. So, and these are intended to equip you with knowledge and skills required to understand ethics in the business environment as well as various professions. And first, we have a book called Business Ethics, the 5th edition, which is by Dion Rousseau and Leon Van Furen. And it touches on what do ethics make? Why do ethics make business sense? What are the social responsibilities around ethics in business? What's the role of ethics within corporate governance? How should organizations manage ethics from within? And given the growing emphasis on corporate governance, you know, the book also touches on, you know, business ethics and business practitioners, you know, as it addresses key ethical issues affecting corporates. The 5th edition also tracks the global developments in areas such as corporate ethical culture and highlights the relevance thereof within the Southern African context. This is going to set you back about 5 buffaloes, so you might want to be ready to part with around 519 Rand. And this is available on takealot.com. The second book is titled Understanding Business Ethics, and this is an e-book by Peter Stanwyn. And in this book, you learn topics such as stakeholders and corporate social responsibility. It speaks to corporate governance and corporate compliance. It touches on ethics and the environment and healthcare and ethics and a whole lot more. And this will set you back by 3.25 buffaloes, so that's 325 rands. And these are shipped like in 5 to 7 working days. So in a week, your whole outlook on ethics could change totally. We're going to touch a little bit more on the business wrap, and we're going to chat shortly to Zanele Kunene, who is our financial expert from BDO Wealth Advisors. Good evening, Zanele, and welcome to our very first live show for the year.
Oh, hey, how are you?
I'm good, thanks, Zanele. How are you?
I'm feeling, I don't know if this is a feeling, but you'll let me know. So the finance minister of Botswana, he announced that in 2020, he hopes or he's planning on ensuring that Botswana has a surplus in their budget. So in the past 3 years, they've been having a deficit. So can you imagine how that can make anyone feel excited and optimistic, like, yes,
absolutely,
okay, this is what we're doing as a country. Yay! But tonight I wanted to speak about something that's not too optimistic. Mm-hmm. According to all of the headlines, the South African Business Index results. So for January of 2019, the index results came at 95.1. And in January of 2018, they were at 95.5, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot of people are like, oh my goodness, it decreased, what's going on? But you must understand that in January of 2018, what was happening? What was the climate? You know, because, you know, everything has an environment. The environment influences what happens. For example, if you're studying for a semester test, you're not that, you know, wow. But when you come to an exam, you're like, yay, I must study. So the atmosphere or the climate of whatever, the climate of whatever's happening really determines what happens, if I'm making any sense. I hope I am. So in January of 2018, we had Ramaphosa. You know, everyone was excited. Investors were happy. You know, it was just one of those. It was just an exciting time. South Africa was living up to that name, you know, Africa's most industrialized economy. You know, we were that it. So that is why the business confidence was that high in January of 2018. Now, come January of 2019, you know, we don't have that Ramaphosa. You know, we don't have that excitement. You know, everyone is waiting just to hear what's going to be happening in the SONA, which is happening tonight, as well as what's going to be happening in the budget speech. So all of us are just waiting. You know, the business confidence index is not really, you know, something to worry about. Don't be like, oh my gosh, it's low. It's really not. In December, we were at 95.2, and even now we're at 95.1.
Yeah.
So it's not something to worry about that much. But, you know, we are hoping, even tonight, I'm hoping to hear if Ramaphosa will say anything about how he will support businesses and how he will make South Africa more attractive to investors so that that could push our business confidence index a bit higher.
Yeah.
We have been looking forward to the budget speech that's going to be happening on the 20th of February. To hear what are they going to say, what reforms are they going to have, and how are they going to split everything together. I know that personally, for the budget speech and even for tonight, I want to hear about what's going to happen with the unemployment rate in South Africa. You know, how are they planning on solving it? What are the plans for that? And I know that everyone else, or all the other economists out there, are hoping to hear about the projected GDP results but the projected GDP data that Ramaphosa will be touching on tonight, and Peter Mboweni will touch on the 20th of what how are they seeing South Africa's growth in terms of our output?
Zanele, like, what do these, like, these indices, what do they mean to, like, the, you know, the average person on the streets? Like, how should, you know, should they take these into consideration? How do they impact people's lives on the ground?
So the South African Business Index, what it helps with is it lets you see the state in which businesses are thinking. So if our index is high, it means that businesses are saying, yes, we are opening our doors, we are expanding, we are open to employment, we are open to, you know, going big and contributing even more to the economy. But when our business index is low, then that means that businesses are contracting. It means that they are not open to employment opportunities. And just to touch on employment opportunities and just business in a sense, Eskom has been going through the most. My goodness. So with Eskom, which is our largest energy supply within South Africa, and they are proposing now to increase the tariff by about 4 times above the inflation rate. So if you imagine this for a business, if you have a small business and you've hired about 20 to 50 people and he has to now pay a higher rate for electricity, that means that now he's going to have to retrench a few people, you know, to meet the cost. So now you've got this individual who's going to be unemployed, and he's going to be going back into his household. And if you're unemployed, what do you rely on mostly? You rely on debt. So that household debt increases. So when it comes to the business index, it allows you to connect the dots to say, why aren't businesses doing good? If businesses aren't doing good, it means households are being affected by that fact.
So this tariffs, like, who is it going to apply to? Is it across the board? Is it specific areas? Like, where this tariff, who does it apply to?
So it goes across all the sectors, and then it is, yeah, it goes across all the sectors. So if you're looking at your energy, your mining, all the sectors is what it's looking at. And that's why it's very important for us to look at that, because all of us are in different sectors. You know, not everyone is doing finance or everyone's doing pharmaceuticals. So it looks across the board in that sense.
Thank you so much, Zanele, for our weekly dose of business wisdom. And after this, we chat more about business ethics.
You're tuned in to the Business Buzz. Business Buzz.
Welcome back to the Business Buzz. And remember, today we are talking corporate ethics. So for those that are just joining us on the line, we're going to be talking a bit to Nkosana Makate, who is the Please Call Me founder or creator. And we're also going to be chatting a bit to Vodacom, as well as Khosi, who's going to give us a business perspective on the issue of corporate ethics. And on social media, we are available at Vow FM, Voice of Vits, and The Business Buzz. On Twitter, we are at Vow FM, and our hashtag is Business Buzz. Now, the Business Buzz endeavors to bring you pertinent content, and this is no truer than through the current Vodacom Makate saga that we just touched on, which is currently playing itself out quite publicly at the moment. Vodacom started the Please Call Me service in 2001, and in 2014, a judgment in the South African Gauteng High Court supported Makate's claim to having originated Please Call Me. It also rejected former CEO Alan Knott-Craig's claim that he had come up with the idea of the messaging service, yet the High Court found against Makate that Geisler had not had the authority to promise Makate such compensation, and that the debt would have expired in legal terms had within 3 years had that legality been finalized. Makate appealed this in court, and it was later found at the Constitutional Court in 2016 in April by Justice Chris Jafter in Makate's favor and against Vodacom. So what we did was we touched base with Vodacom, and we had Lexi Ball, who's the media relations representative, and she responded with a press statement that was released at the Please Call Me conference that was held on the 1st of February in 2019. And in summary, it says that they are ready and willing to pay Mr. Makate a substantial amount of money, the exact amount of which they are unable to disclose as they are bound by confidentiality. They also mentioned that Mr. Makate plans to take the substantial offer placed on the table under review, and that he'll be taking the CEO's determination on review to court. And then they said, most importantly, they want to de-escalate tensions, which if not managed by all the parties concerned, could threaten jobs and the livelihood, as well as the investment into South Africa. So, let's chat to Mr. Makate in a few. So, that was Vodacom's side of the story, and because we're just and fair, we want to hear what Mr. Makate has to say. So welcome to the show, Mr. Makate.
Thank you, madam. How are you?
Thank you so much for making time to chat to us this evening.
Yes.
So on to our first question. So according to Vodacom, they say that the matter was resolved as early as the 12th of January, and that they only needed you to confirm your banking details to finalize payment, of which you denied. Can you please just give us context and background on that?
Yeah, well, what had happened is that you remember that there was a Bloomberg article wherein Vodacom indicated that I have been paid. And when I then came out and then responded that, no, I was not paid, and then they changed tune and said, no, they are waiting for my bank account. So that is really the truth around the story. So the issue of the bank account was only raised in response to my response saying that I was not paid. But I mean, where we are now is that the CEO has made his determination, and that determination is, according to them, it's not supposed to be accepted or whatever. It's a final determination, according to him. So he has fulfilled the obligations that were placed to him by the Constitutional Court. And he is, in essence, a functionary of a court. You know, he's like a judge. And those kind of decisions, you then can take them to a higher level, which is a court. We have not decided whether we are going to the Constitutional Court or we are going to the High Court, but we have communicated that we are taking his determination to review.
There also seems to be a contention around the true inventor of the Please Call Me service. I mean, Vodacom has admitted that Please Call Me was invented and subsequently patented by MTN before you came up with the idea. According to them, Ari Khan came up with the idea before you did, and MTN went on to file an IP protection and launch the service on the 23rd of January in 2001, 7 weeks before Vodacom did. So according to this, someone like Khan believes that you shouldn't even get a cent. I mean, as your idea is not original. What do you say to that?
No. I think that the facts were ventilated. The truth is actually the opposite. The Ari Khan patent, MTN patent, was a subject of the court discussions and ventilation. It was put before my U.S. expert, Mr. Zakovich, who was able to demonstrate to the court that those are fundamentally two different products, and that the MTN invention actually is not what Mr. Ari Khan is claiming to be. And I mean, MTN is also on record. If you have seen my statement that I issued on Twitter on this matter, I do have a confirmation from MTN that their product was an IVR product, which was a different product from the Vodacom product. And I mean, the former CEO of Vodacom, I mean, can fault him on many things, but he did, when this very same issue was put to him in the box under oath, explained that the MTN product was actually a clumsy product, and they eventually had to copy Vodacom's product. And the response that I had from MTN is aligned to that view of the CEO, the former CEO, Mr. Mark Craig.
And to ask rather naively, why did you not get patent rights for the idea right from the beginning? And, you know, some are asking, why did you leave this for so long?
Yeah, no. I approached Vodacom, obviously, in good faith. You know, they were my former employers. I was a young man. I was 24 years old. The world of patents and all those things were unknown to me. I approached them in good faith, and we agreed on partnering with each other to work this thing and to make sure that I'm never removed from it in any how. So, but then what happened was the opposite, of course. We all know. I mean, that matter has gone through the court and stuff, and them arguing that they never had a contract with me up until it was the High Court. The High Court actually found that there was a contract that we had concluded. And there were just those two technicalities that had to be done and dealt with. And the SCA then dismissed me, but the Concord then overturned that and basically changed law in South Africa, provided us with the meaning with regard to the description of debt in terms of the Prescription Act, which changed law as we knew it, you know.
In their press release that was on the 1st of February, Vodacom, you know, claims that they didn't benefit from your contribution as the service was, you know, a free service. And what's your take on that matter?
Now, the product, the Please Call Me product, my Please Call Me product that I proposed to Vodacom was indeed supposed to be perpetually free. And that has proved to be true for all the telcos that have since adopted the product. It was never supposed to be charged. That was intent. It was not a mistake or anything. They actually never even understood it. They thought that they could charge 15 cents for each and every USSD cent. I had to go and address that with Philip Geisler and tell him that no, that's not the intention. If you do that, you'll kill this product. So this thing of saying it was never charged and whatever, it's hogwash. I mean, it was intended that way. And Vodacom, I mean, you know, they keep on lying to the public. I mean, in their own pronounced, even before the CC, I mean, their submissions are very clear. Go to the CC judgment. You'll see that Jafta J does say, and these were representations from Vodacom, that they've generated billions, I mean, of rands with this product, you know, since its inception. So it was intended to be free. I mean, let's not... The MTN product was not even a free product. It was just a normal IVR product that subscribers would pay for. It addressed a different market completely. It was not even talking to the market that I was talking to. So the Please Call Me that I invented was supposed to be perpetually free, and it has been like that. So it was true to the inventor, which is me.
And the revenue that was generated, was that primarily off those adverts that were attached to the Please Call Me's, or what was the source of the revenue?
Yeah, the main source of revenue. I mean, go to Not Craig's book, Second is Nothing. He tells you that the adverts were there. They did bring in some money. However, a chunk of the revenue of Please Call Me comes from return calls. You know, the return calls actually were the target, the main source of revenue that I actually put forward. And also something you didn't know because you're not in the telcos, which is called MTR. It's interconnect fees. When you call and a Vodacom person from MTN, it drops on your network. And in that way, when it drops on Vodacom's network, they charge a fee, which was significant revenue that Vodacom also generated from the product. Mm. So it's the chunk of the money came from return calls, which I actually put down as where the money will come from.
You know, the Concord ruled that Vodacom should pay you a reasonable amount determined by the CEO and that you don't necessarily have to agree on the amount. Does this then not bring finality to the issue legally? What happens now?
Yeah. Now, I mean, people must read the Concord order in full. I don't know what your name. I need to call you your name.
Thank you, Azond.
Thank you. Yes. People need to read the order in full. Yeah? The order starts with an agreement that is binding between me and guys. I mean, that's what we took to court. Mm. That is binding. That Vodacom is bound by that. That's the first thing. And then at the end of the order, it says, okay, we need to get into negotiations which the CEO doesn't need to be part of. Yeah? And then in the event of a deadlock, the matter must be referred to the CEO to determine reasonable compensation in terms of the agreement. They always want to wish that JAFTA never said in terms of the agreement. But JAFTA was very spot on, and he put that, I'm sure, deliberately intent. He meant it to be there in terms of the agreement that was concluded. And that is very simple. It's an agreement of revenue share and a percentage of revenue share. And that's all that we actually had to negotiate about, you know. But they somehow wish that was not inserted in the order. But it's there, you know. And that's what we really take into review.
You received quite a lot of support from political figures. I mean, MSC for Education, Panyaza Lesufi, has been very vocal on Twitter, and there's been a Please Call Me movement that's been created subsequently, which had a shutdown last week. What do you make of this support, and what impact has it made on you?
No, I mean, the support is welcome. I mean, I think I've been in this battle for 18 years, and I've been running it and doing it on my own. And I mean, if South Africans are aggrieved and identify with the cause that I've been pushing and on my own and fighting in all the courts and stuff, I mean, that support is welcome. South Africans, as I've said, I mean, in many forums, are by nature activists. And then if they identify with the cause and support it, it's their choice, and they are entitled to do that. And I cannot come here, stand up and say that I don't welcome that support. Indeed, I mean, it does help, because, you know, this is not something that can only affect Nkosana Makate. I mean, there will be other people as well, you know, that can find themselves in such situations, and people can identify with that.
I mean, the back and forth has taken about, you know, 10 years, and you've been called a liar, greedy. I mean, how have you dealt with all of this?
Yeah, well, I mean, I take them in my stride. I mean, I understand where they are coming from. The facts will be laid out. The facts will talk to all these allegations that people put out there. I'm not a greedy person. I've always been fair. I mean, look at, go to my media statement that I released. Mr. Alan Not Craig Jr. gets 85% revenue share from his VES product. PCM is a VES. I propose 15%. I mean, what's greedy about that? I don't understand where this thing is coming from, honestly. Just because his product was actually not so successful. I mean, had it been successful and generated multi-billions, he'd get his 85%. And nobody will come and get a degree. It's just that PCM has been so successful, you know, that now people will want to bend names and stuff and all those things and call me names. It's just that I had a gem of a product. You know, why mustn't I care what's due to me as an inventor?
Has all this controversy that's, you know, been taking place, has this caused any strain on your personal, you know, family and your professional life?
No. Obviously, these things do affect you. I cannot say that they don't. But I'm a strong and resilient person, and I'm not fazed because the facts I know. And I think South Africa would learn. The story of PCM is not complete. When this thing reaches its fruition and completion, people will then say, wow, indeed, is this what actually transpired and happened here, you know?
So how far are you willing to take, you know, this fight, and what keeps you going?
This is a marathon. And I see it as that. And I think I've ran the largest part of it. The most grueling part of this whole thing for me, and the most stressful part, has been those fast negotiations. These things were not negotiations. You know, people just rocked up there to push their agendas and stuff like that, with no intent of actually negotiating with me in good faith. Their purpose, their sole purpose, was just to push this thing to the CEO and hope that the CEO can just determine whatever that he determines. This thing was probably predetermined anyway, you know. So those were not negotiations. And unfortunately, I was kept there for 3 years in that process, you know. Had it ended earlier, I would have probably been complete now. I would have gone to court, and the court would have actually ruled on the facts.
So what advice would you have for someone who finds themselves in a similar Goliath versus David situation?
People should not think that anything is impossible. If you believe in your cause, if you believe in what you're doing as right, and it has integrity and it has honor, do not give up on it. It doesn't matter how bleak it may seem. But take the fight and roll with the punches. You know, that's what I can advise people. And also be much more clever. I was depending on good faith. I went there, thinking that people would act honestly. Today I think you need to take other precautions. Make sure that you patent, if you do have an idea that you believe in, patent it, approach a lawyer, even if it's just a basic agreement, make sure that it's in place. Don't rely on the good faith. And I had to literally construct and prove to the court that the agreement was struck through conversations and emails that I had, you know, and stuff like that. And that's much more difficult than having a written agreement that lays out, all the terms and stuff and all those things. So I would advise people to do that.
Thank you so much, Nkosana, for your time. And the learnings from that session with Nkosana Makate is that it's so important to not just only rely on good faith and verbal agreements, but sometimes it's best if you can, as early as possible, to go that extra mile, patent your ideas if you can, and make sure that you protect your IP. So furthermore, we also wanted to hear what the people on the ground had to say. So we're going to hear what the voices of the people say.
I sincerely believe Vodacom is entitled to pay the guy. If you consider all the adverts that comes with please call me, it started off plain, but over some years they started incorporating different advertisement. So those don't come cheap, believe me, and it has no peak hours. So consider the fact that each and every year, each and every company gives a budget of a specific advertisement, and they also consider the peak hours. And for the poor guy, shame, it was just rolled down plain. So I felt that he's entitled to however amount it is. And if they want to make it a more accurate amount, they should go back to the very first, please call me. And then, because everything is done through satellite, they can pick it up. Thank you.
Hi, I feel like this guy should really, really be paid. Vodacom owes him a lot. I used please call me so many times in my day, so many times in my youth. And I feel like Vodacom has made so much money from Africa. And they really, really, whatever they're owing to this gentleman is quite a small portion of what they're able to make from our people. So he deserves every cent of it. Thank you.
Okay, basically I think that wherever someone puts in work and comes up with an idea, like, he should be given credit for that, you know? So no matter how big Vodacom can be, for the fact that they didn't have this thing at first, like, I feel like they should give the credit where it's due. So, yeah, that's just how I feel about it.
I feel like potentially the bigger companies can get, they try and wiggle their way out of certain things that can come about. They'll try and figure their way out of things to not need to pay so much.
Yeah, so I think when it comes to corporates, there's a difference between what you do in school, what you study, and what you do when you get to the corporate world is impractical. So I believe with this whole Vodacom saga thingy, the guy needs to be paid the amount of money, because to be honest, minang pilang, please call me. So it's such a great invention that I feel like even 70 billion is actually even less. He actually has to earn money every year that is going to even amount to more than just 70 billion.
You're tuned in to the Business Buzz. Business Buzz.
Welcome back to the show. Now this is the part of the show where we get like some, you know, insight from a business person who is, his job title is investment analyst, and his company and firm is a secret for now. don't ask me why. He knows why. But we are joined by the phenomenal Khosi Dipokwane. Am I saying your name so right?
Khosi Dipokwane, 100%.
Awesome, awesome, awesome. And we're just going to get a business perspective from him.
Sure.
on corporate ethics. And what we want to know is, what is ethical behavior in a business environment, Khosi?
Cool. That's a very good question, right? And what's funny is that on my way here, I was chatting to a colleague of mine, and we're chatting about gravity. Yeah. We chat about funny stuff like that. We were chatting about gravity, and our conversation really was about the fact that one can't really say what gravity is, right? One can never really define it properly. Sure, you can go as far as say it's a force and all of that, but one can never really get to the true essence of gravity. But essentially what one does is that one speaks about the effects that one witnesses from gravity, right? And it's funny because I think from that conversation, I realized that it's quite similar when it comes to business ethics as well, right?
Yeah.
So one would be somewhat misplaced if one were to say ethical behavior or business ethics is ABC, right? As opposed to saying that business ethics has to do with certain effects that come about from corporate action that has, you know, certain implications for society and people. So on the basis of that, I think probably the best way to look at it would be through effects, right? And if you're looking at it through the effects, is who are the parties most relevant within this whole thing? And like three individuals come into mind, right? So looking at business ethics and trying to understand it from an effects perspective, you start thinking about individuals within business, right? And how they conduct themselves, right? So when I was saying you, within corporate X, how are you acting within that particular structure, right? So that's individuals. Two, it's about the organization itself, right? And just how things are structured by the actual organization. And probably the third thing would be, you know, looking at stuff as like business within the context of society as a whole. And that gets very interesting because now, as you see, there's a lot of, you know, stuff pertaining to ESG, right? Environmental and social governance. So that's even ethics, but not so much about the business itself, but about how business is embedded within the societal context. It's a bit of a mouthful in terms of, you know, understanding what business ethics is, but it's really essentially about looking at the effects and looking at the parties who are most affected by that, being individuals within the business themselves, the actual organizational structure of the business, and the broader society.
That's proper Big Bang Theory conversation, yeah. Hey? The effects of gravity. What's the importance? What's the importance of having clearly defined corporate ethics and ethical behavior?
Yeah. I think this goes back to looking at the role of business and just the general corporation as a whole, right? So it was interesting. I was listening to something. As you can hear, I take a lot of people's ideas and thoughts and I just bring them forth. But
patent them, please.
Yeah. That's probably a good suggestion. So like I was listening and someone mentioned that, you know, the role of the corporation in business has changed so much over the past 100 years, whereby corporations and businesses as a whole, just, you know, they control what we eat, they control how we communicate, and they control how we travel, amongst many other things, right? And that becomes very interesting, because that speaks to an element of autonomy that's not been taken away from the individual, right? So now, as Klingi, despite the fact that you're standing here in as the person you are, this belief that what you ate now was a result of some sort of, you know, business processes, I mean, you refer to it as marketing or advertising, anything of that sort, but your autonomy is somewhat been taken and displaced from you as an individual, is now placed and controlled by businesses and corporates. And as a result of this, it's very important to get some sort of regulation and some sort of ethical framework, because these guys, well, the business itself is so responsible for so much of you as a person that it needs to be regulated within some sort of framework, right? And that's really where the role of an ethical framework comes in, right? Because in as much as, like we said, your autonomy in a sense has been somewhat misplaced or taken, it's similar to like a child, right? If you think about a child and a legal guardian, right, that's the same thing. An autonomy has been taken away, and autonomy is only justified if the person or the being who's then responsible for your autonomy is, one, better positioned to serve your interest than you are, or two, has greater ability than you, right? And essentially that's what an ethical framework is meant to do. And as far as your autonomy is being somewhat taken, an ethical framework is supposed to allow that organization and business to make sure that it's, one, you know, serving your interests as an individual, whether within the very business or within society, or, you know, the three aspects that we spoke about earlier. So that's really the role of the framework. The ethical framework is about ensuring that business interests are aligned with society and aligned with the individual.
That was insight. I just want to find out what are some of the criteria for ethical decision making.
Yeah, you know, so there's the whole King Code and King Report, and I think they're on the fourth version now. And essentially, what it is, it provides you with a set of principles and guidelines that corporates are supposed to follow. So, what's interesting about the fourth one, which is the latest, if I'm not mistaken, is that it speaks more about transparency and accountability. And effectively, it's about ensuring that, you know, when businesses make decisions, they are considering the people who are on the receiving end. Not only are they considering them in the decision-making process, but they're also quite accountable to them, right? So I suppose that's probably just like at a real more normative sort of approach. So in terms of trying to get ABC, right? You refer to stuff like your King Code, right? It gives you principle A, B, and C, and this is what a corporate needs to do in order to be acting in an ethically right way, right? But I think also beyond that, one should perhaps also maybe go back to the beginning of corporates and business, and try to understand what was the purpose then, and see how that has morphed over time, and see whether that is still relevant today. Because, I mean, just last year sometime, I was watching a documentary called The Corporation, which is quite interesting. You should check it out if you get an opportunity. The corporation is quite interesting because what it does is that it tracks the establishment of business, right, from the 17th century till now. And it really starts to point out, and you start to see that the role that business had back in the day and the role that the business is playing today is completely different. So, I mean, in the corporation, the documentary itself, they speak about within the 17th century where a corporation was created primarily to serve the interests of public, right, the public people. So it was never about making profit. It was never about, you know, competing as they tend to compete now. But essentially it was about, okay, there's individuals, there's society, and there needs to be a way to channel certain goods to these very same people. And, you know, that's quite interesting, because if you also look at a second story in terms of the emergence of the corporation, it goes back to like the monarch, right? So the monarch back in the, I think it was also like 16th, 17th century as well, they created the corporation or business framework, right, structure, as a way to assist in the exhibitions and the discovery process, right? So you see, back when they were still trying to discover Africa and everyone else, they essentially coupled that within the corporation. And the idea behind the business was that they're going to take, invest the money and channel that through this particular structure and ensure that the investor's liability is limited, right? And once again, referring to those two stories, one can see that the common denominator within that was just, you know, serving the interest of people, right? Mm. Serving the interests of the public.
Mm.
And then, you know, we moved on to the Industrial Revolution, we moved on to the Civil War, and business started to expand even further, right? So that's when, you know, manufacturing industry started, you know, started to boom, and, you know, roadworks and all these infrastructure stuff. And even then, that was also created with the purpose of serving the interests of people. So that was always the case. But then until the end of, like, the Civil War, when the 14th Amendment was passed, right? The 14th Amendment Act, which essentially gave rise to black people and slaves and all of that.
Mm.
Then that's when lawyers then started pleading and claiming that a business should have the same rights as an individual. And essentially that's when we started moving to the point that we are now, where now a business is no longer essentially something that was formed to serve the interests of the people, but it's something that now exists in its, on its own. Right. So I think just, you know, going back to this question in terms of what is the criteria for ethical decision making, right? I think at a surface level, one can then say, okay, look at King Cole, look at King Report. But at a more philosophical, fundamental level, it's like, what was the point of business on day one, right? Go back to basics, to serve public interest.
Mm.
So when making a decision, are you serving public interest? If the answer to that is no, then clearly you're not acting in an ethically sound manner.
I feel you there. And so, like, how do corporates avoid finding themselves in hot water over ethical disputes?
Hey, they're constantly in hot water these days.
Constantly.
It's bad. I suppose the first thing would be like, do the right thing, right? And it sounds a bit superficial, right? But it's do the right thing, because you avoid the water by not going towards it, right?
Mm.
And trying to stay away from it in as much in whatever way possible. So the first thing would be do the right thing. But as I said, that's probably a more superficial kind of at face value like statement. But I think in terms of just avoiding hot water, I think maybe corporates need to look at it in two phases, right? So I like to think of it in terms of like pre-crisis and post-crisis, right? So pre-crisis would be a case of diagnosing, you know, eliminating and repairing, right? Because the thing is, unethical behavior is not a something that just happens at that very moment, right?
Mm.
It's not called
at
this particular time. It's a build-up, 100%. Right? It's a build-up. So there were a lot of things leading up to a point where firm A is then seen as being unethical, right? But if that firm was able to diagnose that, you know, that this behavior that we're doing on is sort of, it's still somewhat right in some sense, but is leaning towards the wrong side, you know, they're able to diagnose that problem, and then they start eliminating it, and then repairing what little damage was then caused. Then they can essentially, you know, avoid this crisis, right? And that's why I'm like, this is more of like a pre-crisis approach to avoiding the hot water. But then I suppose maybe post-crisis wise, and I think this is the biggest thing, and personally it really frustrates me, it's just owning the problem.
Mm.
Mostly when you see corporates are, when corporates get implicated into certain things, they take a very long time before they like, I know, various us, right?
Mm.
They take a while. It's always a case of, you know, we're still, you know, reading into it,
yeah,
you know, or we're having an inquiry or anything of that sort, right? It takes a while. Then only later on, it's like,
task team and everything.
It takes a minute before,
yeah,
before they come out right and be like, hey, this is what we've done. These are the implications, and this is why we're sorry. And lastly, this is how we sort of going to make up for it, right?
Mm.
And I suppose this dovetails well with the second part of this post-crisis aspect, is that even when going back to sort of, you know, to fix for what they've done, corporates need to, you know, do it in a manner that's, you know, it's commensurate with the initial offense, right? And without you know, shaming engineering companies, anything of that sort. But what you see in, like, just engineering companies and all these companies within, like, extractive industries who are typically associated with, like, damaging the environment and all of that, you know, on the news that this is what they're doing is bad to society, then they started rolling up a whole lot of, you know, miseries and stuff, right? As a way to sort of give back to the very same communities that they were, you know, misplacing and treating in the wrong way. But those very same bursaries tie those students to the very same firm coming back, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what you have is, like, sure, you're trying to mitigate, not necessarily even mitigate, but you're trying to repair what you've done. But the way in which you're repairing it does not even equate to the sort of damage that you've done, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, for me, so let's say you're eating something, let's say you're eating your steak. I steal your steak, then I buy a pizza that we both share.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the same approach, right? So they're still benefiting in trying to apparently repair what they did.
Yeah.
So I think so from a post-crisis level, just to sort of sum up this idea, is that, you know, it's about owning up, you know, going out and saying, this is what we've done, this is how we've done it wrong. And then lastly and importantly, it's about this is how we fix it. And fixing it in a way that not only takes back people to where they were before, but essentially to put them at a much better place.
So someone has beef with engineering companies.
Yeah. I'm in finance.
So what are the competitive advantages and disadvantages, if any, that are associated with business ethics?
I think with disadvantages, it's a bit difficult, right? Because, I mean,
reduction in profits, maybe short term.
And I think short term is probably the best way to look at it, because I think it might lie more in the process, right, as opposed to some sort of outcome, right? Because acting ethically takes time, right? Let's be honest, right? If we want to get something done, it's easier if we're like, hey, you know what, just sign this quickly, right? So perhaps maybe the biggest disadvantage at the onset is that it takes time, right? So it could be seen as being inefficient, right? It makes you very slow to move because you're still held back on, you know, trying to get the right stuff in place, right? So maybe that's the one thing. And connected to that is that because it takes time and it's somewhat irritating to so many people, it might not necessarily make it a popular thing, right? So with those who are, you know, corporates that and individuals, but then corporates that act ethically, tend to not be the ones that are most liked, right? So shame, we're not just from doing the right thing, suddenly you're not even being invited for drinks off the way. You know, it's just no longer the popular person. So maybe that's probably the biggest disadvantage is in the process in terms of acting or behaving in an ethical way. It takes time. It just came to mind as well. And I think also that another thing is just a disadvantage is when a commitment is made but is not really followed through, right? So if you look at the auditing firms, what was the biggest problem with that was not the fact, I mean, sure, they acted, didn't act in the right manner, but the problem is that they hold themselves to a particular standard and they tend to sort of commit to acting ethically. So the commitment and the action was misaligned, you know? So that's also the biggest disadvantage, is that if you commit when acting in terms of acting ethically, make sure that when you commit to something that your action follows suit, right? And just to quickly wrap up, I suppose from an advantage perspective, I think it's just really just saving you in the long run. When things are done correctly, you know, in the short term, it's not going to come back and bite you on your behind afterwards, right? So everything is in place and everything will do well. And I suppose lastly, there's maybe also a sort of business case for it, right? If you're acting well, you're acting ethically, essentially you're good for society and society will be good for you. And society essentially is where your business is, what drives your business, right? So maybe there's also a bit of a business case to acting ethically.
And once they find, corporates find themselves in this hot water, what's the best way to deal with like ethical dilemmas?
Yeah, I think these days there's so much information available and so much opinion in terms of what's the best way to approach this, right? So, I mean, assuming, and I think this is maybe what the law does. The law seems to somewhat equate ethics with legality, right? The best way really is to solicit the best legal advice that one can get, right? Because that's just typically, you know, it gives you some direction in terms of how best to approach what you're dealing with. So the best way, I think, would be, you know, soliciting some legal advice, but also at the same time soliciting advice from those who are most affected by the sort of dilemmas in which the corporate may find themselves in. So whether that be individuals within the very same organization or individuals that the organization is serving, it's very important to somewhat get the perspective in terms of what's the view and how best to navigate it. Because at the end of the day, all ethics is just a way of navigating relationships and society, right? It's nothing more than just a robot and street rules for life, right? So the best way to understand it is by really engaging with people who are stakeholders within the entire system and try to figure out what works best for everyone involved.
What sustains an ethics code?
What sustains an ethics code? I think it's probably adherence to it, which probably seems somewhat counterintuitive. Because essentially when a code is adhered to, then it becomes best practice, right? And when it becomes best practice, then it's so easy to follow through. And that's the thing about the world of business, right? The world of business, no one does anything original. I mean, just now you were speaking to the gentleman from Vodacom, right, with the police call. Now, every network has a police call, right? So it's pretty much the same thing. So if corporate A and B adhere to a code of ethics, then best believe that other corporates within this very same space are going to do the same, because that's just the nature of business. It's a copy method, and that's probably the best way to do it. Because if once we start moving away and we don't adhere, then there's going to be revisions of the ethics, right, or of the code, right. And once we've got revisions of the code, then now these different interpretations, and we're just going to begin this spiral, and we're just going to keep going back. So the best way is really to adhere to it, establish best practices, and on the back of that, then you know that will somewhat then multiply itself across society.
We could listen to Khosi talk about business all evening. But because time is not on our side,
so
we just want to thank you for your time and imparting all of that knowledge and wisdom with us. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
Thank you so much to our listeners that came in today. So we had a show today that was focusing on corporate ethics, and we were just getting an understanding of what is ethics, what is this monster called business and corporate ethics, you know, and how does one navigate around it? You know, we heard from our guests today. First, we had Vodacom's Please Call Me inventor, who is Mr. Nkosana Makate, who just gave us insight on his side of the story. We spoke to Vodacom, and they gave us their perspective of the current debates that's happening with regards to the Please Call Me saga. And then we also just had insight from a business perspective from Khosi, and on business ethics being a way of navigating through life, and it's how you go about it that best determines how you, you know, succeed in this definition of business ethics. Shortcuts do not pay off in the long run. So don't forget that we are found on Voice of Wits FM 88.1. On social media, we are at Facebook, Vow FM, Voice of Wits, and Wits Radio Academy. On Twitter, we are at Vow FM, and our hashtag is Business Buzz. On WhatsApp, we are 084-078-4912. And our podcasts are available on www.vits.journalism.co.za/business. Just before we leave, I just want to find out from, we'll find out next time, actually. We'll chat to Grinch. I want to, you know, get a bit more Grinch involved in this show. But you know what? I'm going to spare him this time around. But don't worry, from next week, guys, I want to get Grinch's input. But with that, we've reached the end of our show tonight. I want to thank our technical producer, Kutlwano Serame, our executive producer, Simba Honde. Don't miss the Business Buzz, which is same time next week for more insight into the world of business. Next week, have on the ViFM lineup, a Living Electro. From myself, Tlengi Bazondo, and the rest of the team, take care.
You're tuned in to the Business Buzz. Business Buzz. The Business Buzz Podcast.